County, you know, he is the fit man. Also on the line is Troy Olson, known as KC Royal Man. We are recording a short little podcast tonight that is going to play sometime this week. This is the week of February 15th, and we're going to be doing quite a few podcasts over the next couple of weeks as spring training is finally here. I don't think there's anybody happier in the entire world than one Troy Olson. How are you doing this evening, sir?
Sorry
to interrupt, but yeah, in addition to possibly having him on the show, we've got Darrinus, the batting stance guy, this Sunday. We've also got Jeff Montgomery slated for next week. Sounds like we are in final talks for having a show on February 20th, which is the first day for pitchers and catchers to report in Surprise, Arizona. We may have some surprises ourselves and be doing a live show that evening as well. So. It's gonna be quite a busy couple of weeks of podcasting, and if we can get JJ Piccolo, that'd be the cherry on the cake for sure.
Thank you.
Well, he's going to be a pretty key part of the pitching staff this year. His success is really going to determine if our team is going to be good or bad. I mean, you hate to pin a lot on that guy, but as Duffy goes, so is going to go to the bottom half of our rotation. I think that was our finest hour, Mr. Olson. I don't know what you're talking about. He's a football and basketball guy mostly, although I haven't seen his work during baseball season. He's one of those cool reporters that we had Kim Babb on here. If you wanted to go out and do a story on a Davy girls basketball game, he could. If you wanted to go to the Super Bowl, he could. I mean, he's just one of those guys who just kind of can take any assignment, and that seems to be the way Greg rolls as well. Control with the best of them, too. Talk about how
Welcome back to the Royal Man Report. I am Torrelson, a.k.a. Casey Royalman, and I'm joined on the phone from CBS National, Greg Doyle. Greg, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Troy. How are you?
I'm doing well. So you're just getting back in from the gym today, huh?
Yeah, so if I sound a little bit funny, well, nobody knows how I sound anyway, so nobody would tell the difference. But my voice, I work out pretty hard, and a little-known fact about sweating a whole lot, dehydrating yourself, is that your voice, well, your voice box gets affected. And so my wife always tells me when I come back from a really hard workout or when I used to cut weight to get ready for some boxing fights, she would say, it sounds like you've been sucking on helium. So anyway, if I sound rather wimpy, I'd like to think that's not my normal voice, although it might be.
Well, there you go. You know, and that kind of brings us right into kind of you, Greg Doyle, the person. If people haven't checked you out, they definitely need to go to CBS.com or CBSSports.com and search for Greg Doyle, GREGGDOYLE. And they got to check out your bio because there's a picture of you on there, and you look pretty angry in your picture. And I think that's a good persona for you because it seems like people just don't like you, Greg. What is it like to be Greg Doyle and to get this massive amount of hate mail that you get, that you just put a smidgen into your column called hate mail? What's it like to go through that every day or every week?
Yeah, I do this thing called hate mail, as you said. It's every Thursday, and it used to kind of psych me out. It used to get me down, put me in a bad mood, because for a while there, I really thought that people were going to like, you know, a lot of people were going to like me. Like, I'm going to write with such charisma and charm and whatever I'm going to write with that people will, even if they don't agree with me, they'll be persuaded by what I said, or at least they'll like how I said it or something. And, boy, that went away fast. And it took me several years to actually get over that. It really did. And now I'm over it, and it's just fun. You know, you can't change the world, and everybody's not going to like you. And, of course, you're a jerk like I am, no one's going to like you. But that look on my face, I swear that is not me looking angry. That's just me looking. I'm just looking at the camera, just looking. Ever since I was in grade school, and you know, you'd have picture day, and the guy would say, okay, smile for the camera. No, come on now, smile. No, really, smile. I don't have a smile. Not a fake one. You know, I can smile if someone makes me laugh, but like on command smile, my muscles, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? But my muscles in the face just don't work.
I can understand that. People always give me a hard time for my smile because I have kind of a goofy-looking smile. So, you know, with hate mail, another level of it, you used to probably just get it by email, but now you have a huge Twitter following. Obviously, that's how we contacted you, was through Twitter. And you're very active with people on Twitter. You and I have had exchanges, both good and bad, on Twitter. But I always enjoy reading your Twitter because of kind of the hate mail perspective of it, but also because you get a lot of good information. You were out at Penn State when that whole mess with Sandusky was happening. You were, like, chasing people around the street, just trying to stay in the middle of the atmosphere. What was that like? Kind of take us through that.
That was one of the hardest weeks of my life, actually, which in a way kind of shows you how my life is not, nothing's really gone wrong, really, because that, as bad as what was going on at Penn State was, and it was, you know, it was absolutely tragic and horrific, I wasn't personally affected, so I want to make that clear. That it wasn't about me, but just being there and not as a father. I think it's too easy to say, well, you know, you wouldn't understand if you weren't a father, or I'm a father, so I understand. It's not, you know, I'm a father of two boys, but that didn't even occur to me. I was not walking around Happy Valley thinking to myself, wow, you know, my sons could have been in this story. I was just thinking as a human being. I don't think you have to be a dad or a mom or anybody. Just as a human being, the story was so horrific that it took a toll on me. That week was really strange. I hadn't cried in a couple of years probably, and I broke down a couple times during the week. In fact, one time I was talking to a journalism class teacher on campus, asked me to come speak, and so I started speaking and walked in there with a chip on my shoulder, really angry, and thought they were going to be out to get me, the students, because I know Penn State people were mad at me for a while. And anyway, we were talking about Sandusky and just something about the crime. I mentioned something, a fact in the crime that I've seen it once and will never go back and read it again, because they were asking me, well, how much do you really know the indictment report or what are the grand jury proceeding or presentment, whatever they call it? Do you have it memorized? And I said, no, I've read it once. I'm not going to go back and look at it again. I that's like information I don't need to have, and at least not embedded in my soul. And anyway, I described one sentence in there that I probably will never be able to forget, and as I'm describing it, I'm crying in front of these college kids. So anyway, that was not a good week. It was not a fun week at all.
Well, and kind of let's make this a little different view with Twitter. Obviously, that's one side of Twitter, and that I think, you know, it was pretty amazing to follow your timeline through that, because from somebody that is neither affected by it, that was a huge supporter of Joe Paul, and still doesn't know completely how he feels, in being me, about the whole thing on if Joe Paul is just a scapegoat or if he really deserves all the hate he's getting for this and everything. Sure. You know, I'm not sure where I'm at on that yet. But kind of with that, it was kind of interesting to follow at least your view of how Penn State was taking this horrible, horrible thing that was going on. Now, you got that side of it, and then you can interact with people on Twitter as well. First off, how long have you been on Twitter, I should say?
I was probably one of the last ones to the game. Maybe 2 years, and it's been around 3 or 4 years, and it took me about a year of watching or hearing about Shaquille O'Neal and his silly tweets and Lance Armstrong and his tweets and whoever the pioneers of Twitter were, the sports pioneers, tracking them and not tracking them, but just hearing things about it and not really understanding at all what it was. And I went on some TV show and they had like it was about Twitter, you know, the impact of Twitter on the media. And they had two of us on there, and I was the bad cop, and because I'd already written about Twitter a time or two, and they knew that I didn't like it, so I'm basically calling Twitter the pet rock of our generation, and it's stupid, and just embarrassing myself in hindsight, because clearly Twitter's, you know, absolutely the wave of the future, and it's the wave of the present, and I was one of the last ones to see it, so I've been on for about 2 years.
Now, you're not alone, because there's a lot of people on TV that had said that. I remember it being called fat at one point, and that it was supposedly going down because it had had its first month. This was like a year ago. It had its first month where it didn't have a gain of people. But now you look at it, and TV shows have hashtags, you know. So it's definitely a big part of American society, and it's something that, as far as I'm concerned, hopefully will stay around for a long time, because it's something I love. What is your favorite part? Now that you're on it, you're integrated, you appreciate Twitter. What's your favorite part of Twitter, and what's your least favorite part?
From a sports perspective. Sure. My favorite part is that it's like your own personal news service, depending on who you follow. And a lot of people follow a lot of people. And I've got some ADD issues, and so I just can't have the tweets, you know, not the ones coming to me, but just the people I follow, they update their own Twitter pages. I can't have too many of those, because I'll miss stuff and I'll get frustrated, and, you know, it's just not good for me. So I follow about 30. But those 30 pretty much give me everything I need to know. And so if I've been at the gym for a couple hours, I go in, and you've got to go to my website and track what's going on. And that will tell me a lot of stuff. But Twitter will tell you all the big news, plus the snarky news, plus a smidgen of, oh, by the way, you know, Whitney Houston, rest in peace, died today. So, I mean, Twitter will just tell you everything you need to know in snapshots. So that's my favorite thing about it. My least favorite thing about it, I guess, is the fact that you can be misunderstood in 140 characters. You're trying your best to be understood, and I'll write things that I know I've said a certain thing, and I can't control the IQ of people out there reading. You know, to be absolutely blunt about it, I can't control that they don't get it, and so they will come back at me, and worse, they'll retweet me to their followers with some, and because they're retweeting it, they have to cut mine down a little bit, you know, to make room for their own words, and they'll say something that's blowing me up. Like, for example, yesterday about Jason Whitlock. I wrote that people want him to get fired. I understand what they're saying. I personally don't think he should be fired, but this is a chance for him to learn. And I then proceeded to blast him. I said he's an egomaniac. He needs to grow up. He's realized he's not always right. But I think he's got a lot to offer in journalism if he just could, you know, take this and get better at it. And people were retweeting me saying, so you're saying jokes about Asians are okay. And then, retweet Greg Doyle. Let's not fire Whitlock. So that's the most frustrating thing about Twitter, is that people can take your words, and I hate to use the out of context thing, but they can either out of context it or completely flat out miss it and then retweet it to their people and make you look awful. I got unfollowed by about 50 people yesterday after saying Whitlock shouldn't be fired, but he needs to grow up. And I think a lot of that was because I was getting retweeted by people that didn't understand what I was saying.
Well, and one thing I have learned is you can't, I'm a bit of a local celebrity here. I'm a super fan for Kansas City, for the Royals, if you don't know that. But I have a little bit of a local celebrity, I guess, and if I want it or not. And I get, like, I'll go through and I really enjoy following the MUKU rivalry because I'm not a fan of either team. And this year it's been the best year ever because while KU football's been down, Mizzou basketball's been probably the best it's ever been, and that's actually going to lead me to a question I'm going to ask you about. But there'll be days that I'll be talking a lot about KU, and I'll just get unfollowed by all the Mizzou people. And then a week later, I'll be talking a lot about Mizzou because they've got a good game going or something. Or, you know, I'm giving some love to Mizzou, and all of a sudden I get unfollowed by a bunch of KU people. And they tend to come back. So I think those 50 losses, they're gonna see at some point, they're going to probably end up back their way anyways, because people are just so fickle with their follows, it seems like, when it comes to that. So
yeah, and I used to be a lot more obsessed with Twitter. In fact, the Happy Valley thing changed me in a couple different ways. Don't need to get into all of them. I really don't need to get into all of them. But one way it changed me is I was really obsessed with Twitter going into that week. You know, I was obsessed with and I'm big into numbers and things like that. And so I on a daily basis, I don't do this anymore, I'll make that clear, but I used to, on a daily basis, look at who started following me yesterday. You know, your new follows, and some days it might be 3 and some days it might be 30 or whatever. And I would go through just to see if I recognized anybody, old friends from high school or, you know, famous people, whatever, just to see who's following me. And so because I would do that, I would, to see what you're talking about, the fickleness of it, is I would see someone is following me and I've seen you like 8 different times as a new follower. Like, why do you keep leaving and coming back? You know, stay away or stay, but what are you doing? But anyway, bring it back to Happy Valley really quick, is that was so intense. And, gosh, and I hate to use that cliche. It kind of makes you think, realize what's important and what's not. But that week was so intense. I was kind of ashamed of myself for caring about my number of Twitter followers, A, and B, wanting to see who's following me. It's just not worth it. It doesn't matter. Who cares? And there's more things in life to worry about than that. So anyway, I haven't looked at the followers since then. I've relaxed because when you really care about your numbers, and I'm sure most of us do, and I still care. I'm just trying to not care so much. It's a hard thing to go through life when you're measuring yourself. Bill Simmons has 14 billion followers, and I like to think of him as a peer of mine, which probably is a joke to a lot of people, but I like to think we're equals. But, you know, on Twitter, that's the only number I can compare myself to his. He's 14,000 times more viable than I am, so it's kind of hard to swallow.
Yeah, but I don't eat a lot into that because it's also what people find interesting on Twitter. Because one of my co-hosts is Fake Ned Jost. He's got a big game. He's funny, and he was a fake. You know, he was supposed to be a fake version of the real Ned Jost. And he's kind of moved away from that and actually changed his name now to the Fake Ned to try to drop the Jost part of it. But he's got twice the followers I do, plus some, because he's funny and he's just so out there. Whereas I try to stay a little more in and just, you know, opinions on sports. I'm not trying to get way out there with anything crazy. And the crazier you are or the more that, like, Bill Simmons, he's got his podcast following. You know, you don't do that. You're not out there. You've got your column, and so you've got your people that respect you through that. But he's got so many more venues of information that he's getting out to, I guess. That's probably why you see more of that. And I'll tell you this, being somebody that runs a podcast, podcasts, you know, my podcast, The Roman Report, it actually gets gaining more followers than I am as a person, because people care more about the show side of things than they do what I offer as a person. So I don't know about the Twitter followers, about getting caught up on that. It's just one great thing about it is you get the people that follow you that enjoy what you say, and that's the people that you want around anyways, because, or for you, I think some people just like to follow people they don't like. Like, we see that a lot here with some of the people, the local radio guys here, because there's guys here that are like, again, going back to the KU-MU thing, there's big KU homers here, there's big MU homers here. And Bob Pesca, who's a morning guy on 610, people follow him just to hate on him. And I think you probably get a little of that, too. And that, to me, is kind of crazy of how you can live your life just wanting to yell at somebody all day or see things that you know are going to make you angry. Same with the MU-KU thing. You being a guy that's not in the area, on a national level, what is the MU rivalry, KU-MU rivalry being played at this year, at least in the basketball sense? Is it something that has a little bit of national talk since both teams are pretty good?
Yeah, I guess, but I think there's so many of those. There's so many of those. Washington State is huge. Now, it's only huge in that state because nobody really cares outside of there, but there's so many rivalries that are huge. BYU-Utah, right here around here, until the brawl happened this year, Xavier-Cincinnati probably was flying under the radar, as well as should have. You know, it's a huge rivalry in Cincinnati, but it's not so big everywhere else. Nobody cares. That's sort of my take on KU-MU, although it's clearly better. I'm not trying to insult it. I'm just saying I realize that's the world to people in that region, as well as it should be, just like Florida State is the world to people in Florida. Outside of it, I think when they play each other, it's just like two ranked teams playing. I don't. To me personally, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, I don't think to myself, wow, these schools really hate each other, and they're both in the top 10. That's a great game. No, I just think this two top 10 teams is going to be fun to watch because it doesn't, you know, because I'm not there. I can't pretend to know how intense it is. I assume it's intense. like North Carolina plays North Carolina State every year. Carolina's always good. NC State's typically not nearly as good, and yet that game is everything to those folks. So I just, you know, y'all's game there is like everybody else's rivalry game everywhere else, only this year it's we're going to pay attention because of the rankings, but I can't get too much more into it than that.
All right, I'm going to give you kind of a couple quick fires here because I told you I'd take you only 15 minutes. I've had you longer than that. So,
I'm doing just fine. I really am doing fine.
Okay. What's your opinion on the Big 12? Just as a whole, with everything that's gone on with Nebraska leaving, now Missouri leaving, Texas A&M, you know, Colorado. What's your opinion as far as will the Big 12, do you think the Big 12 has what it needs to stick around now? Or in 5 years, are we going to be seeing the Big 12 suffering again?
Yeah, I think the Big 12's fate is out of the Big 12's hands, honestly. Same goes for probably the Big East. I think at some point the leagues that are calling the shots right now, the ACC, the SEC, the Big Ten, and the Pac-10, those are the big four. You know, it used to be there's a Big Six, and there still is six BCS leagues. I mean, I realize that, but they're still in that subset of six dominant conferences. There's four really calling the shots, and the Big 12's not one of them. So when the four big ones decide what they want to do, if they want to grow to roughly 18 each, and I realize the Big East has got 37 million teams, and it just doesn't matter because, you know, half of them suck and half of them don't play football, and the other half of them play football and suck at that. So that's three halves, and the Big East still isn't whole. How about that one? But there's four major conferences. When they decide what they want to do, at that point the Big 12 will decide, it will have its decision made for it. Now, if the four big ones want to become 18, then they will just swallow up and divvy up the Big 12, and that'll be that. And if they decide they want to stay where they are, then the Big 12 can, you know, through no strength of its own, continue. That's just kind of how it looks from here.
In retrospect, is there anything that the Big 12 could have done differently? Around here, we blame Dan Beebe for everything, and I think it's fair. But is there anything that the Big 12 should have done differently to have made themselves one of the Big Five instead of there being a Big Four?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think the Big 12 it was a fluke. A fluke of geography and things like that, and some of the strength of your conference already. And the Big 12 is probably weighed down by some of the schools at the bottom, you know, football-wise, the K-States, Iowa States, Colorado. Of course, Colorado left, but I think it was hurt by some of that, and also by the fact that there's a lot of bad basketball schools in there, too. It just didn't, you know, doesn't do much for it. And this geography of it, look, between the Big 12 and the Big 10, one of those two was going to win. That's how it is. And the Big Ten happened to win, and I think the Big Ten was going to win because Ohio State, Michigan, and the educational aspects of it. You know, the Big Ten's a really good academic league, not that the Big 12 is not. My dad went to OU, so I'm not trying to bag on the Big 12. My mom went to OU, too, come to think of it. But, like, in the East, the Big East and the SEC, I'm sorry, the Big East and the ACC, only one of those was going to win. The ACC is going to win. That's just the way it's going to be. And so the Big 12, Beebe got a lot of flack. I'm really not sure. I don't care who your AD was. I don't think anything different was going to happen.
Getting back to a little more about you, the writer and the person.
And I'm sorry, if you don't mind, if I can just correct myself real quick. I don't care who the commissioner was. I'm not sure what difference would have been made with the Big 12. But I'm sorry, go ahead. Get back to my favorite topic, which is me. What is that?
Yes, let's talk about you, because I know you love to talk about you. So on your profile on CBS, you talk about and you have a link to a story about you getting choked out by an MMA star. Without telling the whole story, because obviously people can go to your bio, which we'd love for them to do, and read this whole story. But just for me, I read this, and I thought to myself, I actually had went to some amateur fights here in Kansas City out at Voodoo Lounge in Paris, and they do, I think it's Blue Corner Fights. And I had an opportunity, because I was working behind the scenes, to actually go and sit with the people that put this together, which are guys that have fought in Strikeforce and UFC and low-level guys, nobody that had ever made anything. But I asked one of the guys then, I said, what's it like to, first off, be in a fight like that? And more importantly, what's it like to lose a fight like that where you get choked out? I said, kind of walk me through what that's like, because to me, I just can't understand, you know, why anybody would, first off, step into a ring like that and get the snot beat out of them, but let alone get choked out. And he told me the story, this professional fighter said, he remembers the first time he got choked out, he got stuck from behind and got caught, and he went down, and he said when he woke up, all he remembers is six people standing over him, and the first thought that went through his mind, not was that he just lost oxygen to his brain, but that was, damn it, I lost the fight. That was the first thought that went through his mind, because he realized that since the doctor was standing over him, he had lost the fight. He'd been choked out. You actually volunteered to have somebody choke you out just to see what it was like. First off, what's that thought process like? And when you first approached this MMA fighter about this, What did he say? Did he laugh? Did he think you were ridiculous? Kind of walk us through that part of it.
Sure. The reason I did that is I'd gone to UFC 68, is I believe the number, at Columbus, Ohio, and I went there to blow that sport up. I'd never, you know, I'm slow. Apparently, I'm slow. I was slow to Twitter. I was slow to mixed martial arts. I went there to blow it up and fell in love with it from your pressure of seats right there. So, I mean, it was just so charming. It's a strange word for it, but there's so much camaraderie between the fighters. It, you know, it's not professional wrestling where they act like they hate each other and spit and snarl and all that. They actually, they're in there playing sport, doing a sport, and when it's over, they're hugging and giving five and comparing notes, and it's just really, it's charming to watch that. So I fell in love with it. But I saw a couple guys tap out, and I thought to myself, why would you ever tap out? Why would you do that? You know, you stay there until, and you keep trying to get out, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But also I was thinking, go to sleep, you know, that's a wrestling move, the chokehold in professional wrestling, and then we all know that's fake. So I just didn't know what was going on, so I wanted to know what it felt like to be forced to tap out. So I went to this gym and talked to this guy. His name is George Gurgel. He was a UFC fighter for a while and broke even at best. And anyway, he's not a star by any stretch of the imagination, but he's Rich Franklin, who's a UFC middleweight champion at the time, works out there also here in Cincinnati. You know, I walked in, told Gurgel I wanted to, basically, here, I'm a local sports writer. I want to get choked out. I want to know what it feels like. And he's, you know, thinking I'm an idiot, but says you got to sign some paperwork. He's all about the attention. He's publicity. So he's like, okay, fine, that's fine. I'll do it. Has me sign a waiver form, which is a little bit daunting to sign a waiver, saying I'm not going to sue you guys if I die right now. And so I signed it, and he gets behind me and is about to put on the rear naked choke around my neck. And Rich Franklin's standing there, and he says to me, you know, just tap me on the arms when you feel yourself going. And I said, I'm not going to – actually, I'm sorry. Franklin's not standing there yet. It's just me and George on this mat. He goes, tap me on the arm when you're about to go out, and I'll stop. And I told him, I'm not tapping. I want to know what it feels like to go out. At that point, Gurgel calls Rich Franklin, who, again, is the UFC middleweight champion. And I don't even know what this means at the time. But he calls Rich. Hey, Rich, get over here. And he tells Rich, Rich, this idiot wants me to choke him out. And as George starts to choke me and I'm starting to go out, I can feel it. He tells Franklin, hey, who's got the camera in case this guy craps himself? And that's the last thing I heard when I fell asleep. And I woke up not thinking I lost a fight, because, of course, I wasn't a fighter. But I woke up, and my dream was that I was on a Caribbean beach or somewhere, you know, like Bahamas, something like that. I was on a nice island beach when I hear Gurgel's Brazilian-American voice, hello, hello, wake up. He's like patting me on the cheek. So that's a nice memory to have, I guess.
It's just, that whole thought to me is just crazy, because I did, you know, like I said, when I was hanging around these guys, I always thought, you know, what would it be like for me, somebody that's nowhere near being a fighter? I mean, anybody that has seen pictures of me knows that I'm an out-of-shape, 30-year-old man that wears tights to a baseball game, you know, which started off as something that I thought was going to be funny and last for a couple of months, and that was 2 years ago. I couldn't imagine what that was like, but I have briefly thought about what it'd be like just for a second to step in that octagon. But I couldn't imagine what you did. That just blows my mind. And I give you super props for doing it, because that's just crazy to me.
Well, you mentioned that you can't imagine getting in there and getting the snot beat out of you. And that is not how any of those guys think about it. They're thinking about, I'm going to get in there and beat the snot out of him, you know, because they're all that confident. And so it's not like you think to yourself, you're not going to the executioner. At least some of them are and don't realize it. They don't think it. But anyway, a lot of us – There's room in the world for all of us. We need some people wired a certain way and some people wired a different way. And I was the past week in Indianapolis, the Super Bowl, and wanted to get a workout in. And like I said, I fell in love with that sport, and I didn't really do it. But I fell in love with it to the point that I started boxing. And because that's all I can, you know, I don't want to do jiu-jitsu at age 37, which is how old I was at the time. I'm 41 now, but started boxing and enjoy it. And Chris Lytle is an MMA fighter, a UFC veteran. And I tweeted him, because I know he's from Indy, and said, I'm going to be in town. Would you like to spar? And he said, sure. So anyway, I sparred. I went six rounds just boxing with a UFC fighter. And that's a blast. I mean, a lot of people would say, why would you do that? You're an idiot, or that's stupid, or whatever. But if you're wired that way to push yourself, there's nothing. I enjoy that more than I enjoy writing a really good story. Not that I know what that feels like very often, but I really enjoy sparring.
I mean, Greg, to me, it's just really interesting to see that part of you. And I think people – that all the people that need to hate on you need to take a second and really look at you in the full perspective of your bio and what have you. One really good thing that you have accomplished in your life is you finished second in 2010 in the Associated Press Sports Editors Annual Contest for Column Writing with over 175,000 circulation. I was looking through this when I first saw this. You actually used it in a hate mail article one time. Somebody saying, you know, that you had misquoted them or something, and you're like, well, if my editor trusts me to edit my own stuff, I'm sure I can edit your piece and keep everything you're trying to say intact. You know, I did finish second in this contest or whatever. Ironically, there was some Kansas City writers in there, but you finished second. What was that like, I guess? When did you find out that you'd been nominated for this, and what was your reaction to finishing second? Were you upset? Were you happy?
Oh, thrilled. No, thrilled. The APSC is, I want to say it's kind of like the Oscars for our business, but it's not nearly as exclusive as that. You know, the Oscars, one guy gets Actor of the Year, and there might be four nominees, and that's it. Well, the APSC breaks it down in certain categories, so you don't have a guy from the Boston Globe competing against a guy from the Podunk Daily Times. You know, it's just not fair. So you do it by circulation. So it's a lot easier to win an APSC award than it is to win an Oscar. I won't make that clear. But anyway, it's the best we got. It's the holy grail of our business. And the internet sites just recently got, in fact, last year, just got added to it. We could actually compete. And they put us in there with the biggest category, which, as it should be, because we have a lot of circulation too, I guess. I mean, it's free, but we have a lot of eyeballs. So this is the first time in about a decade that I was able to compete and try and win something. And I'm very competitive anyway. And you know, you want validation. That's what you want. And we all think we're good, or at least a lot of us think we're good. We all have. It's like I told you about fighters. They all think they're going to walk in there and beat the snot out of the other guy. It's not the way it's going to be. But if you don't think you're going to beat the snot out of him, then you have no chance. So same thing goes for writers, I think. We all think we're good. We all think we're the best one in the room, or we think we're one of the best ones in the room, or why bother? And winning a contest like that, finishing second, actually getting a top 10 is so hard that people talk about they won an APSC, even if you get a top 10. They only rank 1 through 5. If you're 6 through 10, you're honorable mention. They rank 1 through 5, but even if you get a top 10, even if you finish somewhere 6 through 10, you still tell people, and your resume will say, you won an APSC award in 2007 or something, because it's just kind of a big deal. So to make it into the top 5 was enormous to me, and then to finish second was enormous, and just enormous. But I'll say this, it doesn't really mean anything, actually, because it's a fact. I was second best in the country that year. No, it's not a fact. It's kind of like the mythical national championship in college football. It's just a couple judges get together and decide what they like the best. And if you happen to write a couple stories that for whatever reason agreed with those judges, then you're going to finish ahead of some other people that maybe didn't. So it's a fluke and doesn't mean anything, and yet it means everything. It probably makes no sense at all, but it's the only way to look at it from my perspective is, wow, that's a huge ego boost, and yet at the same time, it really doesn't mean that much.
Well, it was only you and another guy from CBSSports.com, Ken Berger, that were included from the internet. And then there was a couple of people from the Washington Star, Arizona Republic, Boston Globe, Detroit Free Press, Indianapolis, and our own...
Sam Mellinger, yeah.
Yeah, he's a friend of our program, and he's actually a great guy. Sam actually came in studio with us and did a Royal Man report. And
Let me tell you something about him. First of all, I love him. I know him a little bit. You know, I've met him at various things. You know, I see him at events and know him on Twitter a little bit, but I know him in person some, and real nice guy. You talk about a humble talent, and he's one of the best. I mean, he's, you know, there's some guys on that list that I would look at and say, wow, you know, that person made it. You know, they're probably really not that good, and I'm not going to tell you who, but there's a couple people on that top 10 list that just aren't that good, and there are some people that probably would tell you I'm one of those. It's possible. I don't know, but Sam is not one of those. I mean, he's one of those guys, and he's young, but he's exceptional and will be exceptional for a long time, and you wouldn't know it if you're just like, if you meet him, if you're talking to him, you know, it's a rare gift to be that good, and he is that good, and to not come across like Whitlock, for example. Well, you know, he comes across like, yeah, I'm that good. That's how he comes across, and the truth is he's not. You know, he's good. He is good, but like as far as pure writers go, you know, there's a whole level between that guy and Sam Mellinger, and Sam, you would never know he's that good.
No, I totally agree with that. And him and Ken Babb, they have a, I assume it's a fun little war on Twitter between them. They kind of spar back and forth, but I can't imagine they don't actually. I assume they like each other. I assume that what they're doing back and forth is all play for Twitter and what have you.
And him and who? Sam and who?
Ken Babb.
Oh, yeah, I don't even know. I don't know how those guys get along in real life.
It's kind of fun because that's the only time you really see Sam is him and Kent will jokingly spar with each other on Twitter. But he's very much straightforward and, you know, kind of the honest guy, like what you see is what you get kind of deal. And so I have a lot of respect for Sam Mellinger. Like I said, we had him on the show, so, of course, that's another reason that I have a lot of respect for Sam.
Well, and I joke with him when I see him, and this is probably stupid, and even more dumb to actually say this out loud to somebody else, but to me he looks like a watered-down version of, and again, a watered-down version of this guy is still a compliment, but I see a resemblance, you know, like he could be the ugly brother, but still damn good-looking, of Leonardo DiCaprio. Do you see that?
I have never seen that this way, but we will definitely get Sam's opinion on that. And,
oh, he knows. And believe me, Sam knows. When I see him, I bring it up, and like the other day, I saw him at the Super Bowl, actually, and I think his hair's grown out, maybe, or something. Something's different about him. And he was on a treadmill. That's what it was, or on the elliptical or something. I walk in the gym, and there he is. And I didn't recognize him, and I walked up to him, and I get on the machine next to him, and he looks over and smiles and says hi. And at that point, I realize, oh, Sam, hey. And I said to him, I literally didn't know that was you. I thought I was sitting next to Leo, and I didn't think that. I mean, but I didn't recognize him, but. You know, I think it's okay. Look, I'm married, and, you know, so as far as straight and all, whatever, I'm straight as it gets. I'm a married guy. But he's a good-looking man, and I think he does look like Leo, an uglier version of Leo. But that's like saying, oh, she's an uglier Cindy Crawford. I bet she's still good-looking if she's an uglier Cindy Crawford.
Well, you know, and I can appreciate that. You know, that's pretty funny. If you had told me that I was going to call Greg Doyle and do an interview with Greg Doyle, and we were going to get a soundbite on that Sam Mellinger looks like Leonardo DiCaprio. I would have never imagined that. So it's a nice little extra to this. As we close out here, are you going to get a chance to come to Kansas City for the All-Star game, or is there somebody else from CBS that gets that beat?
Yeah, we've got three full-time baseball writers. So it'll be one, and they've never sent me to an All-Star game yet, and I presume, and that was when we used to have one guy, then two, and now we have three. So we won't now. So I guess not. But I'm going to be in your vicinity. I mean, you're close to St. Louis, I guess, and Omaha. I'm going to be at those two places. I'll be circling you during March Madness.
Well, I'll tell you this. If I get a chance, maybe I'll try to jump down to one of those places and see if I can catch a beer with you or something when you're in St. Louis and Omaha. Those are both only about 3 to 4 hours from Kansas
City. See, I'm a lot nicer. I'm a lot. If you actually talk to me, there's, and I don't want to name any names because, you know, I've done that enough in my life and gotten in enough trouble, but there are some sports writers that people say, yeah, he's a jerk. He's a monster. And in real life, he really is a jerk. He really is a monster. And I named one of them earlier today, and you can just guess which one it is, but there's a couple of them out there. And I'm happy to say that is not me. Of course, everybody thinks that's not me. No, that's really not me. But I do write like a jerk and a monster. I get that. But yeah, please, the beer will be on me, or rather, my CBS corporate account. I'm not buying it for you, but my company will.
Well, that's awesome, Greg. And thank you so much. If you ever do happen to get into Kansas City, don't be scared away by the guys at Kansas that's wearing tights and a cape, because it seems to be something that's not going away for me. But I personally want to thank you for taking the time to come on the Royal Man Report today and take the time to do our little podcast and put a little CBS aspect to it. So thank you very much for coming on. And, Greg, I really appreciate you taking the extra time today. Thanks so much.
Troy, you're welcome, and thank you for having me. And last thing is, if you're wearing tights, the beer's off.
Yeah, I won't wear tights to the bar. That's one common misconception is I actually – you know, like you were saying, you know, you're married and whatever. I have a girlfriend. I'm a straight guy. I don't know where the tights idea. Well, I mean, it was obviously a Superman character, but, you know, why it stuck or whatever it has. But, no, I do not wear those in public unless I'm coming directly from a ball game and don't have time to go home. And even then, I normally have a pair of wind pants in the car. So,
I promise I will have. How about Sam Mellinger in tights? Now you got something going. But just to bring a full circle, and with that, please can we hang up before I say something worse?
That'll work. I'll talk to you later. Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye, Troy.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
it's impossible. I actually had to go through and trim my list the other day, so I'm kind of just over 4,000, whereas I was a little bit above 5,000 at one point in time. So. That's the fun we talked about before. That's the fun of Twitter, is that you can kind of dip your toe in and dip your toe out. And, you know, if you catch something going on, you're great. If not, don't worry about it. It's kind of like the Matrix. You just plug in and plug out. Sam Stefanaro. This has been the World Mayor.